Contented Media presents Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, an original podcast series with Mark Hunter and Arthur Van Pelt.
Hello and welcome to the first episode in this new season of Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. My name is Mark Hunter, author, blockchain writer, and proud host of this here podcast, and I am once again joined by semi-professional Craig Wright debunker Arthur Van Pelt as we take a second ride around the crazy Craig Wright carousel. Listeners to Series 1 will know all about Craig Wright's antics over the past 8 years in his increasingly desperate attempts to be heralded as Satoshi Nakamoto, and there is plenty more on the table for 2022, with numerous lawsuits and even a potential BSV fork to get our teeth into over the next 12 months. Arthur and I will be endeavouring to bring you monthly updates and insights that you just can't get anywhere else into what Craig Wright has been up to of late, as well as the all-important historical context, as we attempt to make sense of the ramblings of a man who has just entered what could well be his make-or-break year. Arthur, are your hands and arms firmly inside the vehicle?
Yeah, for sure, Mark. Yeah, let me tell you, I'm happy that you decided to give the Dr. Bitcoin series a follow-up, because as we've seen lately, there's still so much to tell in this saga.
There certainly is, yes, and I am delighted to be back as well. So let's get started then.
Sure.
It may only be January, but we've already seen action in the key Craig Wright legal cases in the last 5 weeks or so. So let's take them one by one and see what's happened. We'll also give you a bit of background for each case so you can understand what they're about and what's at stake. Firstly, the Copa case. This one started in April last year and is taking place in the UK, which is bad news for us because hardly any information about British cases of this sort is made public. COPA stands for the Cryptocurrency Open Patent Alliance and was formed in September 2020 by Square and some other big hitters in the world of Bitcoin, including Coinbase, Blockstream and Kraken, three names that anyone familiar with the Craig Wright story will instantly recognise as the axis of evil as far as Wright is concerned. Following Wright's attempts to get the Bitcoin white paper stripped from the internet on the basis that he had copyright over it, COPA took legal action against Wright 9 months ago, asking the High Court to rule that Mr. Craig Wright does not have copyright ownership over the Bitcoin white paper. Central to this premise, of course, is the suggestion that Wright is Satoshi Nakamoto, which, needless to say, COPA does not agree with. COPA is essentially demanding that Wright prove in court that he is Satoshi Nakamoto, something that they clearly feel he can't do with the evidence at his disposal, something that listeners to this podcast will likely agree with. Nothing much happened in the COPA case, at least publicly, until December 2021 and the conclusion of the Clyman versus Wright case, when there was an interesting development regarding the evidence that COPA was allowed to submit. Before we explain what happened, let's remember what Wright had told a Slack channel on November the 12th last year. Ironically, the COPA case will fall apart before it even starts. In a few weeks, the case will end, and the evidence will show that I created Bitcoin alone. So, Arthur, did the COPA case end last month as Wright predicted?
No, as far as I'm concerned, certainly not. On the contrary, what we've seen instead is that COPA quickly grabbed a large amount of the Clyman versus Wright material that was filed after the trial ended. So I presume that will be exhibits that were used at the trial and transcripts of the day-to-day hearings and witness questionings. And COPA dropped that material in their own case against Craig Wright. Now, of course, Craig desperately tried to avoid that, and there was a hearing about that event on December the 10th, but the judge in the COPA case, Honorable Paul Matthews, ruled on December the 22nd. In the result, I dismissed the defendant's application to strike out and for an evidence exclusion order and allow the claimant's application for permission to reamend the particulars of claim. And on a hilarious side note, Matthews also ruled something about Craig's doctor title. Did you notice that, Mark?
I did. I certainly did. We will cover that a bit later. Don't worry.
Okay.
But first, let's look at the reaction from the Wright camp, which was both predictable and hilarious. In his BSV channel, Wright mocked what he called the first tweet from COPA claiming they've won something or other, which is particularly rich when you take into consideration the victory laps that CoinGeek takes when Wright simply files a motion. Wright then claimed, "Won my ass, I want the trust documents in court." At this point, we'll turn to the ruling itself from Judge Matthews, which contains the following quote from Wright's defense team while pleading his case. "Findings or rulings made in the Kleinman litigation are of no relevance to and are inadmissible in these proceedings. Therefore, paragraphs 63 to 65 of the particulars of claim fall to be struck out." Given that Wright claims to have wanted such evidence included, he must have been livid that his lawyers had tried to get it struck out. Calvin Ayer didn't seem to spot the irony of Wright's Pinocchio impression when he replied to the COPA tweet with, "You all missed the point. They are lying about what actually happened and what it means." Sometimes you just have to stand back and admire.
Yeah, indeed.
Wright's legal team had also tried to get other evidence struck out, including emails that COPA's lawyers had flagged up as being fraudulent, as well as several allegations about Wright's credentials. However, Judge Matthews ruled that the allegations cannot properly be objected to on the basis that they are not relevant. They are relevant to the question of the credibility of the defendant, and in addition, paragraph 66A is at least potentially relevant also to the question whether the defendant was in control of the earliest Bitcoin created. In my judgment, those allegations, if proved, are potentially probative of issues in the litigation. Judge Matthews also had something to say about Wright's other claims. "The defendant argues that they are or would amount to satellite litigation, they will cause unfair prejudice and also cause an undue burden on the defendant. I do not accept these submissions. In my judgment, these questions are exactly the kind of debate which will need to be had in order to test the defendant's claim that he is indeed Satoshi Nakamoto. To my mind, they are not unfairly prejudicial or an undue burden, but on the contrary, exactly what must be faced. This is in any event a fact-heavy case. The game is certainly worth the candle. They are proportionate to the point, and if the defendant survives these tests, it makes his claim all the stronger." Arthur, this last point is particularly interesting because, as Judge Matthews points out, if Wright survives these tests, then he'll be in a really strong position. But the fact that he's attempting to wriggle out of being challenged on them is very telling, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Craig Wright appears to be very well aware that the material that COPA has brought into the case is not exactly advancing his Satoshi position, of course.
No, and it follows a pattern we've seen recently, where Wright talks a good talk to his followers, but behind the scenes his lawyers are doing the exact opposite of what he says. This happened in the Kleinman case with Bombshell Monday, when all his evidence was supposed to come out in support of him being Satoshi, and yet his defense team filed a motion to dismiss mid-trial before he could even get on the stand and reveal it all. It wasn't just the content of Wright's objections that troubled Judge Matthews, but also the fact that they were being made so early in the case. He noted that matters of evidence admissibility are usually determined at trial by the trial judge or at least in application heard close to the trial, and that it seems very early to be dealing with questions of admissibility of evidence at trial. Arthur, what do you think this says about Wright's case that he's trying to get evidence and allegations struck off at this unusually early stage?
Yeah, Occam's razor will tell you, of course, that he is not feeling very secure about this stuff.
No, again, he's boasting about having all the evidence on his side, and yet his lawyers are trying to make sure that what they don't like doesn't even reach the eyes of the trial judge, presumably because they're worried the judge will admit it. I think actions speak louder than words in this case, certainly, at least up to now. Regarding these attempts to get other evidence and allegations thrown out, Judge Matthews dismissed them all in turn because the claims were either too broadly worded or were matters that could only be decided at court. As Arthur touched on already, there is one final point to note here about this incident, which refers to Wright's doctor title, which some, Arthur among them, dispute. Wright's team actually complained that court documents didn't refer to him as Dr. Wright, which Judge Matthews referenced at the end of his judgment. The claim was begun against the defendant under his full names. No application has ever been made to the court to alter the intitulement of the action. No argument has taken place on the point, and no authorities have been referred to. The point has been sprung on the court at the last minute. Dr. Wright is justly proud of his academic achievement, but I do not think the court should be dealing with this minor dispute at this very late stage and on such an inadequate basis. I mean no disrespect to Dr. Wright by not doing so. Honestly, they can't even get that right. You can't help but laugh.
This is such a funny thing in the whole,
It's so petty.
Yes, absolutely.
Wright gave an interview just after this ruling in which he levelled a very odd accusation at COPA.
Is there anything you can or you're allowed to say about COPA that you want to say at the moment, or is it just a case of let the lawyers kind of back and forth?
It's just delay tactics from people who want to keep their scam going. That's fairly much it.
Needless to say, the actual content of the COPA tweet didn't make it into the interview. Talking of the Kleiman case, there have been a couple of updates on that front this month as well. For those with very short memories, Wright was adjudged to have committed conversion against W&K Info Defence Research LLC over improper ownership of intellectual property and was ordered to pay $100 million to the company. This figure, which Wright still hasn't paid, could be substantially upgraded following Ira Kleiman's legal team applying for $43 million in prejudgment costs. Arthur, what are prejudgment costs and why is the figure so high?
Yeah, this is basically all interest starting from the day of the actual conversion in 2013, which was November the 7th of 2013, when the Australian Supreme Court approved Craig's false claims against W&K. You might remember that the Supreme Court performed no truth-finding process and accepted Craig's claims and forgeries on face value. So this interest calculation starts exactly there on November the 7th. In 2013, and it goes all the way up to the day of the verdict of the Kleiman versus Wright case, which was December the 7th of 2021. And with percentages used between 4.75 and 6.83 per year over the verdict amount of 100 million, this quickly amounts to a massive 43 million interest to pay on top of the 100 million of the verdict. Now, Judge Bloom still has to approve this motion by Ira Kleiman, but I expect her to do that shortly.
And this is on top of the post-judgment costs, which I think are made up of interest accrued all the time the money's not being paid. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And it will be around $700 to $800 per day, what they are currently calculating.
Now, Wright's legal team didn't take too kindly to this claim and filed a rebuttal on January the 18th, which said of the potential award: "This illogical demand is obviously improper because the evidence at trial of the property's value in November 2013 was a fraction of the amount awarded, which was based on the property's value 8 years later. That value and the verdict support 38 days of prejudgment interest." In short, Wright's legal team said that the proper way of calculating interest wasn't from the time when the IP was taken, but instead from the day at which the IP was valued at its highest amount. According to them, this was October the 30th, 2021, when Wright himself put the value at $252 billion, meaning that the amount of pre-judgment interest should be in fact just over $500,000. Something even bigger happened on January 6th, when Kleiman's counsel filed for an entirely new trial. The reason for this was down to evidence on one particular aspect of the trial, which was used by the plaintiffs when the judge had allegedly ruled it inadmissible. Arthur, what was this evidence and how did it come to light?
Well, looking back, it's not really a surprise that Ira Kleiman as a person, and not in his capacity of representing W&K, make no mistakes, there were two plaintiffs in this case. But again, Ira Kleiman as a person is asking for a new trial. Ira Kleiman is active on Twitter every now and then, and already before the Christmas holidays, he tweeted about his irritation that Craig's counsel had brought up elements of the relationship between Ira Kleiman and his dead brother Dave Kleiman from the years that Dave was still alive. And it was, of course, before April of 2013 we're talking about. And the relationship between these two people should, of course, not matter in this court case. And the judges had already ruled that it was forbidden to mention details about it. Even if these two brothers thoroughly hated each other, for example, well, which they didn't, of course, but just as an example how that works in court, the fact remains that both brothers had each other in their wills. And that's the start of it, and it's immediately also the end of it. So what they thought about each other, how many times they called each other or visited each other, is totally irrelevant. But it appears that Craig's counsel tried and succeeded to make it relevant anyway. And this became painfully clear in an interview with one of the jury members after the trial. So allow me to quote from Ira Kleiman's motion for that new trial. "Following trial, Law 360, which was the website where this interview was posted, secured an interview with one of the 10 jurors who served on the case. That interview confirmed the obvious, confirmed what the estate was concerned about all along, and confirmed the court was correct in excluding these highly prejudicial comments from trial. Defendants' violations of the court's motion in limine order impacted the consideration of the evidence and affected the verdict. Now, the article explained that Ira's failure to visit Dave in hospital affected their decision. And then they quote this juror, "In 3 years he didn't go to the hospital," the juror said. "That clouded my view as far as what the actual record stated."
Yeah, it seems to have had more of an impact than might have been actually assumed at trial. The strength of this argument is entirely subjective and depends on the interpretation of events by the judge looking at the complaint. Now, I'm only an outside observer here, but it seems to me that the fact that the complaint is going back before the original judge favours Wright, because Judge Bloom made the call to bar discussions of the relationship between the brothers and then allowed certain elements of it to go through during trial. And the chance of her admitting her mistake is, I think, less likely than an impartial judge ruling that she got it wrong.
The Carolina Bolado interview is pretty strong evidence that Judge Bloom was probably too soft during trial and maybe did not foresee the full effects of Craig Wright's counsel's shenanigans. It's hard to predict, of course, what will happen next, but I lean towards the outcome that she will honor some or all of this motion for a new trial. But to be honest, I'm not sure what legal machinery she has in her pocket to award some or all of this motion, so I'm not sure what will happen next.
While the prospect of a new trial might please the lawyers who can continue to rake it in, I have a feeling that anyone else involved on both sides would meet such a ruling with little more than a sigh of dread.
That's for sure.
Either way, that's clearly one to keep a lookout for. We also got an important update from Wright's case against the plethora of Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin SV developers, which we'll call the Pineapple Hack case. The names of those being sued by Wright in this matter include longtime nemesis Greg Maxwell, friend-turned-enemy Roger Ver, and the Bitcoin Association for BSV, which promotes the adoption of, you guessed it, BSV. So yes, Craig Wright is suing his own promoters. This is my favourite case in that the premise behind it is so stupid. This is the case, as I'm sure you'll guess from the title, that concerns Wright's claims that he was victim of the world's biggest robbery when billions of dollars worth of cryptocurrency was stolen from him thanks to a pineapple Wi-Fi device being planted in his house by a gang of hackers. For more details about this incident, we suggest you check out Series 1, Episode 5 of this podcast, but the reason Wright invented this ludicrous robbery claim is so that he could get a court order to force these developers to break their respective blockchains and hand him back the coins he supposedly lost. The Bitcoin developers have banded together to defend themselves, and this month they received some good news. Arthur, what was the issue at the heart of this ruling?
I do try to follow it for a bit, but it's sometimes a bit hard because it's a large group of people from different backgrounds. But as far as I understand it, there are three or even four separate groups being sued, and they do not all operate together. They all have individual counsels, or they have chosen so far to be not represented. So the Bitcoin developers, and then I'm of course talking about BTC here, they have joined forces and are being represented by Bird and Bird. Roger Ver probably has a separate counsel, but his counsel is not mentioned in the latest ruling, so I'm not sure what's happening there. And the two Bitcoin Cash developers also have their own counsel. As far as we know, the BSV Association is not being represented by any counsel, and I think we can guess why that is. They intend to be complicit. They probably intend to comply with Craig's demands at the soonest occasion they can find. So the issue at heart of this ruling is that the developers, excluding BSV Association, they had requested a so-called security deposit of Craig Wright. Because, as was mentioned late last year by one of the parties, your client is a company incorporated in the Seychelles with no tangible assets, and there is every reason to believe that it will be unable to pay our client's costs if ordered to do so. Now, and here is where we see the ATO and Court Florida rulings from way back. Let's go back to 2015-16, when we saw ATO making their findings known in their reports about the Tulip Trust. Court Florida did the same, but much later, I think 2019-2020, that this whole Tulip Trust did not exist and does not have any assets. This is now returning to Craig Wright as a boomerang. No one believes him anymore when it comes to these Tulip Trust things. So it strongly appears that Craig shot himself in the foot by trying to use the non-existent Tulip Trust with non-existent assets in this case.
There are some very interesting points from this ruling which we'll dig into now. Firstly, we should note that the entity suing the developers isn't Craig Wright himself, but the famous Tulip Trading Limited, the company at the heart of the Tulip Trust, as well as the stash of 80,000 Bitcoin in the One Feeks address and the 30,000 Bitcoin in other addresses that was presumably hacked at the same time. Now, as Arthur said, Tulip Trading is based in the Seychelles, where business records and financial returns are not made public. And this, according to two of the developers, made it impossible to obtain information about the claimant's business activities, its assets, or its ability to satisfy any costs ordered against it. The court stated what it had expected Tulip Trading to do with regard to this, saying the obvious response would have been to provide evidence of its ability to do so. So, Arthur, did Wright's team do the obvious thing and provide evidence that Tulip Trading could afford the costs if it lost?
No, they did not provide any evidence, of course, because they can't. Instead, they argued that the developers had not provided any evidence of their contention, and that Tulip Trading didn't have any money, which they never actually accused them of. They just said that they had been prevented from finding out. So Wright could just have produced a balance sheet from Tulip Trust or Tulip Trading, but instead he tried to divert attention by accusing the developers. And the judge classed this as deliberate reticence.
Yeah, it's quite telling that instead of spending 2 minutes printing off a balance sheet, they have to deflect away from the company's financial position by accusing the developers of doing something they didn't do. Deliberate reticence doesn't mean Wright and Co. are actively hiding the information from the defense, but it does mean they are intentionally making things difficult for the defense to get the information they want. As we'll see, this approach backfired massively on Wright's legal team. Wright's lawyers had also tried to use the apparently imminent retrieval of the equivalent of the Satoshi stash in BSV tokens as further proof that they would be able to finance the losses, stating that they were working on a tool that would enable someone who owns but cannot access the BSV to regain control of them. Arthur, how did the court respond to that little nugget?
Yeah, this was also unacceptable to the judge, who didn't think that this would happen. He said, in order for the claimant to access the BSV, the first defendant, BSV Association, would have to implement any software that Dr. Wright or Enchain developed, and its user would have to agree to use it. But there is no evidence that they would do so. And he summarized by saying, in these circumstances, even if the software is available in the next few months, in my judgment, there is insufficient evidence to show that the claimant will be able to access the BSV.
Yeah, this is yet another example of Wright telling his BSV group time and time again that this will happen or I'm going to do this. But he hasn't actually got any authority to do these things. And when he actually comes up against someone in a decision-making position, it all falls apart and he never says anything, hoping no one ever brings it up.
Yeah, exactly.
There was some good news for Wright, however, in that the court ruled that Tulip Trading Limited was not created purely for the exercise of fraudulently claiming the coins at the heart of the case, and that due to the fact that its claims to the stash date back to 2011, it has a legal and beneficial interest in the Bitcoin. As we learned throughout Series 1 of this podcast, however, the documents backing up this 2011 ownership, which the court didn't look at when deciding on this count, are known to be backdated forgeries, which the developers pointed out, a matter that will undoubtedly come up later in the case. The court also rejected a claim by the developers that Wright was trying to hide his assets from possible enforcement action by holding them overseas. The court then discussed the basis of the claims made against the developers and the reasons behind Wright bringing the suit in the first place, which elicited this response from the court. I accept that the merits of the claim that the defendants owe the claimant the duties alleged are not on their face strong. As to whether the claim is brought in good faith, I was shown some very intemperate remarks on social media by Dr. Wright, suggesting vengeful motives towards the defendants, and some intemperate remarks by the developers about Dr. Wright. But motive is not sufficient to convert a claim which otherwise has legal merit into one brought in bad faith. Arthur, that's an interesting point to note, isn't it? That the court already considers the case against the developers to be not strong.
Yeah, I would think so. It's very interesting that this comes up. One can presume that judges will not judge too soon, too hard, before having looked at the full case and hearing a judge state this in the very early stages of this case is probably very telling already, if you ask me.
Wright had argued that Tulip Trading shouldn't have to post security because it was the developer's fault if he couldn't pay due to the fact that they were the ones blocking access to the assets he would use to pay it. He also reminded the court of an open letter he sent on October 19th last year in which he offered to freeze the relevant assets in Bitcoin on the Bitcoin Cash ABC chain and use that as security. With regard to the first claim, the court rejected Wright's suggestion that he would post the security if the developers would give him access to the OneFeex and other coins, because that's the entire point of the bloody case. The court report put it a little more formal than that, stating, "It, the claim, is founded on two assumptions, namely the ownership and that the defendants owe the duties alleged, both of which may be held to be incorrect at trial. That is the outcome which gives rise to the need for the protection the defendants seek." Arthur, what did the court have to say about Wright's offer to burrow into the Bitcoin Cash ABC blockchain and grab the coins from there?
Yeah, Mark, this judge is certainly not stupid, because hear what he said literally. Even if it was technically possible, the proposal would require the defendants to expend their own time and resources in rewriting the relevant software code and persuading users of the Bitcoin system to adopt these changes. Whether this can be achieved is an extremely technical issue in dispute in the claim. However, there is no legal basis, and the claimant did not put forward one, for requiring a defendant to expend his own time and his own money in order himself to produce his own security. Well, amen to that, Mark.
Yeah, he clearly knows his stuff, this judge, and it seems that this might be someone that Wright won't simply be able to bamboozle with technobabble like he does with his followers. So, after all that, it won't be a surprise to hear that the court rejected the majority of Wright's arguments and ordered him to pay the security costs up front. The judge summarised that Wright had been asked to provide evidence of good financial standing and had refused to do so, and that, on the totality of the evidence, there is reason to believe that the claimant will be unable to pay the defendant's costs if ordered to do so. On February 26th, when this episode was not just being put to bed but was in fact fast asleep, the court offered its ruling on this matter. The ruling showed how the defendants together put their security costs to Wright at some £330,400. Amazingly, given the astronomical fees demanded by themselves in the past, Wright's lawyers criticised the hourly rates charged by the developers' lawyers, saying a figure of £175,000 was more reasonable. However, the court ruled that the average hourly rate was well within the bounds of reason, although it did permit a 30% reduction on the total, putting the final figure being claimed at just over £248,000. This wasn't all, however. The charge of deliberate reticence cost Wright an extra £73,500, putting the total bill for Wright ahead of the trial at just shy of £322,000. And all because Wright couldn't prove Tulip Trading Limited was solvent. Wright's offer to pay the security deposit in BSV or Bitcoin was rejected due to the inherent volatility of cryptocurrencies, which the judge ruled could make the security deposit effectively valueless throughout the duration of the case. There's also the concern for Wright that if the developers win on jurisdictional grounds and succeed in achieving indemnity costs, Wright could be looking at a further £100,000 to add to that bill, not to mention the reputational damage he would suffer. Poor Satoshi. Arthur, if Tulip Trading Limited is broke and Wright hasn't got access to these various Bitcoin stashes he claims to have owned and lost in the past, where will this money come from?
Yeah, where has the money come from so far since 2015? who is Craig Wright's sugar daddy? Calvin Air, of course. It wouldn't surprise me that at some point we find out that, again, Calvin Air is paying the bills for Craig Wright here.
Yes, I think Calvin could well be bailing out his favourite son once again.
Yep.
In mid-January, Wright went on a multi-day marathon rant to his BSV followers regarding the arguments he expected the developers and others to put forward in their cases against him. The rant itself is so long that we can't sadly repeat the entire thing, which is a shame because it's quite deranged, but here are some highlights. Those who are telling you that users and UASF, soft forks, matter are lying. Those who are saying that the process in Bitcoin involves social consensus in any manner are defrauding people. Those who tell the court that developers don't control the network in Bitcoin and that they are not fiduciaries are misrepresenting the nature of Bitcoin. In the court processes coming up, we are going to demonstrate, technically, how people like Core are not only laying, presumably lying, but are actively and knowingly purging themselves and committing offences by fraudulently referring to Bitcoin in the way that they are. We'll show how the developers act to change the network at will. We will show how every so-called expert who walks around talking about social consensus is not just lying, but is actively defrauding people. We will demonstrate how nothing but users do on Bitcoin makes any difference to what the developers do. We will demonstrate how the developers, not the majority, but the few in control, lie in court, lie in Congress, and defraud everybody. We will show how Bitcoin really works. And he continued in this vein. So far, have seen things set up. The other side have gone hard on their false narrative and lied blatantly to the court. Not mildly, not a mere error of description, but rather a knowing this information that has been told to the court over and over again. As we bring this up, this has formed a position that they no longer can avoid. The other side have lied to the court. The other side have defrauded the court and have attempted to mislead a judge. Not a slight error, not a misunderstanding. The people in Core, in doubling down and saying how Bitcoin works, have now dug the grave that they are going to be buried in. I will not be demonstrating merely that they control Bitcoin, but rather that they are lying in court processes and perjuring themselves. BTC Core are not a bunch of random developers. They are a funded, paid, capital-rich partnership that is designed to avoid law and evade taxes. In this, they fraudulently claim donations as a means towards tax evasion as they attempt to defraud. There's much more of this kind of stuff just written in a different way, but the same message is repeated throughout. Bitcoin developers are actively and wantonly defrauding people and lying under oath. Arthur, can you put into plain English exactly what they're supposed to be lying about?
Yeah, basically that Bitcoin, as we know it by its ticker BTC, which is now the number one cryptocurrency on all metrics, from adoption to scaling to being legal tender in one country already, is, according to Craig Wright, the fork or an airdrop. He gives it several names. But yeah, he says that is not Bitcoin. And that's total nonsense, of course. But yeah, he's saying it.
What about on the technical side, the things that Wright says the developers are actually lying about? I mean, he says that four nodes control the Bitcoin network rather than the tens of thousands, as all the data suggests. I mean, how does he come up with that?
Well, I think he just takes the four biggest mining pools that are currently Foundry, Poolin, F2 Pool, Binance Pool, I think. They have currently in total roughly 60% of the hash rate as we speak. Presuming those pools only host a few nodes each for redundancy, backup reasons, then we get to around, say, a dozen nodes. So what is Craig actually saying? The control of the network remains with four nodes. In addition, exchanges have always been easy to control. If you can cut off banking, this is very simple. You cut off the operation of the exchange. Next, every single exchange operates on the internet. For that matter, every single node operates on the internet. More importantly, they have domain names, banking ties, and requirements to use services such as AWS. Everything in this industry about decentralization is a complete fabricated fraud. So, okay, let's break that down for a bit. Mining nodes, four or a dozen, is what Craig claims control the Bitcoin network. Well, they don't. What Craig doesn't understand is that mining nodes create the blocks, and while doing that, they enforce the protocol rules. And when finished, they send these new blocks to all the nodes on the network. And there is no limitation in the Bitcoin code that only mining nodes should verify their own blocks. Because here you have to understand how proof of work works. Proof of work has two parties, workers and verifiers. The workers are the mining nodes, and the verifiers are the miners and the full nodes together. Both these node types host the full blockchain. So these nodes, they verify, and the full nodes, with little effort on small devices like Raspberry Pis, as Satoshi envisioned, that the blocks can be approved and added to the blockchain. And those verifying nodes enforce the protocol rules again, for a second time, to perform this job. So it can be said that these verifying nodes keep the miners in check. And we have seen this play out with the block size war in 2017 when the user-activated soft fork was playing. And it were the full nodes that signaled for this update, while many mining nodes were against it. But the majority of the nodes that was reached by counting also the full nodes, they wanted this upgrade, so it happened anyway. Now, and this is how Bitcoin has proven to be sufficiently decentralized. And at the same time, it proves Craig Wright totally wrong. And it's funny to notice how he calls Satoshi his very own design a fraud, by the way. But yeah, let's be honest, Craig doesn't understand Bitcoin very well. We heard him, for example, also recently claim something along the lines of, in Bitcoin, you own the tokens on your machine. They're not on the blockchain at all. While Bitcoin is defined in the white paper as a chain of signatures, which are stored in the blockchain, and the only things stored on your device are the public and the private keys to perform transactions with the value appointed to the tokens on the blockchain. So yeah, these little but important details is where we see Craig is failing to be a convincing Satoshi.
Yeah, he's been going on and on about this on an almost daily basis in his chat room. So he's clearly setting a lot of store by it, and also threatening anyone who's ever dared to suggest in public that Bitcoin is decentralized with like claims of perjury. But it seems to me this is just another attempt to reassert this narrative that the Bitcoin protocol was intentionally derailed soon after he created it, and that people have been intentionally centralizing it on behalf of MasterCard or whatever. But again, there's no evidence for this, and all it really is an intentional misrepresentation of the Bitcoin white paper to make people think, oh, he's telling us what it really means. I mean, how do you imagine he would try and prove this in court?
Yeah, my guess is he will repeat this mantra as much as he can, and the opponents in these lawsuits will try to disprove it with the way how Bitcoin really works in real life. There's no way Craig will have a convincing way to prove this, as Bitcoin, as we know, it works perfectly fine with 15,000 nodes, and it's actually much more, but I guess Craig took the number of publicly visible nodes here. And a Bitcoin expert witness like Andreas Antonopoulos, who also played a role in the climate lawsuit, as you might remember, will be perfectly suited to explain this in detail to a judge, I'm sure.
Yes, we'll have to wait and see on that one, but I think that's going to be a very interesting situation when it actually comes up.
Yep.
If he hadn't done so already, Wright made the extent to which he was going to spend more of Calvin Ayres' money on legal bills completely clear. Any developer, and I mean developer on any blockchain system, who seeks to lie and tell people that Bitcoin is cryptographically protected when it is not encrypted, will not only face the full raft of the court because of their misleading activity, but will face perjury. If a lawyer of these people goes to court and makes that statement and doesn't check the fact that they are promoting lies that are easy to discredit, I will make sure that those lawyers face sanctions as officers of the court who are lying to the judge. So there we are, Bird and Bird, watch out, Craig's coming for you. In the rant, Wright further discussed his conspiracy theories over the alleged hijack of Bitcoin in 2009 and 2010, which we discussed in our Series 1 bonus episode, Writing History. Wright said, "They actively sought to change Bitcoin to make it something else so that they could make it friendly for criminals, that they are working with criminals, that they are aiding crime. What you're going to find in court this year is not a soft response to these people. I'm going to ensure that they face justice. When I finish with these people, they will be facing criminal charges. The people in court will have to stand in front of a judge and say their lies. When they do, we will tear them apart and we will show them for the criminals and the layers, presumably liars, and the perjurers as they are. I didn't create Bitcoin to be a system that acts outside the law. I'm not an anarchist. I wasn't an anarchist, and Bitcoin was never ever released or notified on the Cypherpunk mailing list. So there we go, Arthur. The conspiracy dates back to October 2008, when the Bitcoin white paper wasn't released on the Cypherpunk mailing list.
Actually it was, Mark. The cryptography mailing list was on MetsDAO, where Satoshi posted the Bitcoin white paper on October the 31st of 2008. And it is a mailing list that can be traced back to the cypherpunks, actually. Because listen what Wikipedia says about this. The original Cypherpunk mailing list and the first list spin-off, the CodaPunks, were originally hosted on John Gilmore's Toad.com, but after a falling out with the sites up over moderation, the list was migrated to several cross-linked mail servers in what was called the distributed mailing list. And the CodaPunks list, open by invitation only, existed for a time. There are several lists today that can trace their lineage directly to the original Cypherpunks list. The cryptography list, which was on MetsDAO.com.
Now, before we get too worried for our developer friends and their lawyers, let's not forget what Wright said in September last year regarding the Clyman case. In November, because of the court case, I will be explaining Bitcoin at a level that nobody has ever heard before. I will explain how Bitcoin can scale to global levels and how it could have done this 10 years ago. More, I will explain how even an army of Raspberry Pi systems could have created a network that would scale into tens of gigabytes. Antonopoulos and other so-called experts will talk about what they think Bitcoin should be. I will stand up and explain the technology at a depth that nobody has been able to comprehend, given 12 years of utter failure to understand my technology. Arthur, Wright must have presented this to an empty courtroom because no one who was present at the trial can remember any technical explanations along these lines, and certainly not to a depth that nobody has been able to comprehend. This never happened, did it?
No, this didn't happen. We were indeed promised a bombshell Monday with evidence like Craig's credit card receipts of buying Bitcoin.org in August 2008, but in reality, nothing. And the only thing mildly interesting was a handwritten meeting minutes paper that could have been forged, so to say, a week before the trial. And I have reasons to believe it was forged in 2019, actually, looking at the scan of the paper. But the excuse that popped up after trial is that Craig is saving his best evidence for the other cases that are still running, of which the Pineapple case is just one. We also have the COPA copyright case, we have the Hodlnaut with two cases, we have the Peter McCormick case still running. So yeah, to cut a long story short, nothing, no technical explanations and no bombshell evidence came up in the Clyman case.
Yeah, this argument of holding back evidence for later trials is just hilarious. If you have what you think is convincing evidence in your favour that you can present in a trial, especially one worth billions of dollars, you don't withhold it, you test it out to see if it's as strong as you think it is. Then, if the defence picks holes, you can try and patch it for the next time. They seem to think that this evidence is unsinkable like the Titanic, but at least they tested her first.
Yeah, again, it didn't happen.
Outside of this mega rant, Wright was also in good form regarding the nature of private keys when it came to proving identity, telling his followers on December 28th, question from SS, has Craig publicly stated why he doesn't want to publicly sign the message with a key from Block 9 or with some other known Satoshi key? I am talking about a statement in the last couple of years, not the 2016 Sartre statement. Answer from CSW, it is not a solution and f*** off with this. Honestly, it is everything Bitcoin is not. If this is what you want, honestly, f*** off. I am tired of this crap. You do not prove crap at all this way, and I'm more than sick of complete wankers stating this as they are too lazy to do real work. No. I say you cannot sign in reverse. You cannot use an unregistered key to sign, by definition. I said, proof has nothing to do with keys, never will, and if you think that, you need a lot of study as you are completely deluded. I said, Bitcoin will move because of court orders. It will not move by keys, ever. It will be moved as keys are f***ing not required. Please listen and please think. Code is not law, keys are not identical, nor will they ever be. There will never be any proof by keys as no f***ing duck thing exists. Keys do not, cannot, and will fucking not ever in any way prove identity, and stop thinking the crap a bunch of drug-addicted shit for brain fools want to believe. Wright went on. If you think that keys are ever used to prove identity, you are ignorant. Honestly, if you have a small inkling of a concept of an idea that keys will ever be a means to prove identity, you may as well drink the core Kool-Aid and join the cult in when that ends. Keys do not provide identity. Keys do not prove ownership. Keys are not a name. Keys are not even required for recovery and seizure in Bitcoin. It is not crypto. Your title is registered on a house. They help with stolen cars too, and will with Bitcoin. Wright went on. Let me get this straight. I have not ever promised you I will move Bitcoin using keys, and I have categorically stated keys have nothing to do with identity or proof. If you are here for test, you don't understand Bitcoin, and it is time you stopped having shit for brains. Honestly, do dumb of you listen, think even? You don't win by playing the other side's game, ever. Bitcoin, even BTC, will move from the original, and it has nothing to do with keys. Keys are not Bitcoin. Wright went on. Bitcoin will be seized. BTC will be seized. 2022 is the year that criminal proceedings are not just traced, they will be taken. And your keys mean shit all in this. Arthur, there is clearly a lot to unpack in this rant. What's your personal highlight?
Oh, there are several, but yeah, let's take this one. I said Bitcoin will move because of court orders. Well, this is so extremely hilarious. It's like a court ordering that a $100 bill with number 123 ABC, whatever its location and whoever holds it, has to return to person XIZ because see court order. Yeah, this is of course not how an adequately decentralized monetary system like Bitcoin works. Developers have to build the code, nodes have to accept the rules change. With nodes, I mean the mining nodes and the full nodes, and there are quite a lot of them. And all other users have to accept that the fungibility of Bitcoin will be broken to its core. Naja, that's not going to happen. Everybody will stop using such a system, of course. And aside from the fact that Craig Wright can't even prove that he is Satoshi, he never registered any Satoshi address with their private keys at the notary. For example, his proof for the possession of the one fixed address and the other addresses is questionable, to say the least. So yeah, all in all, this is going totally nowhere.
For me, it's the fact he says he has never promised he would move Bitcoin with keys. Now, let's go back to May 2016 and the fallout from the signing sessions. Wright first promised he would prove he was Satoshi with the Sartre blog post, but then he undermined his own efforts by using a publicly available key in his supposed message signing. So that was quickly figured out as fraud. The day after this, he produces a blog post entitled Extraordinary Claims Require Extraordinary Proof, which he since deleted, in which he says, I can prove access to the early keys, and I can and will do so by moving Bitcoin, which he called insufficient to prove his claims, but something that was necessary. Sure enough, the following day, everything was set up for him to send the coins, but he bailed at the last minute. Arthur, do you think this is a strong enough rebuttal to Wright's claims that he has never said he would send Bitcoin with the keys?
Yeah, for sure. Craig conveniently forgets here that is exactly what he promised to Rory Salen-Jones, to John Matonis and Gavin Anderson early May 2016 here. So these three individuals, hoping to see extraordinary evidence to prove an extraordinary claim, all sent him some Bitcoin on the Bitcoin address of Block 9, of which Craig claimed he had a private key, and with the expectation that Craig would return these Bitcoin amounts to the addresses where they came from. Well, yeah, we all know how that ended. Rory, Gavin and John are still waiting for 6 years now.
Yeah, you'd think he'd send them back as a matter of courtesy, but no, he's still got them, still holding on to them. Wright, in fact, addressed these signings in a message to his Slack group on January 12th, in which he appeared to admit to faking the press signing sessions, saying, I did not give the real one to the BBC, as they promised me a low-key thing. They swore no camera, just an easy entry into all. If the BBC did not lie, the hash above is the one for the file that the BBC, Economist and GQ was given. I just never copied the signature when they thought I did. Arthur, can you explain this in relation to the signing sessions of 2016?
Yeah, the only thing I could say is that Craig Wright is lying through his teeth again here. Those who have read my long-form article, Signing Sessions Debacle, know that several days before the media outlets, Economist, GQ and BBC would show up for the proof sessions, the planning for those days, for April 26 and 27, around those days, was sent around to all the stakeholders. And what did we see on that planning? An on-camera interview by the BBC scheduled for April the 27th of 2016. So the BBC did not lie. Instead, Craig is trying to rewrite history again. The real reason he didn't hand the signatures to the media, nor revealed it in the Sartre post on May 2016, is that he couldn't produce it.
Yeah, and Wright continued on the thread of the signing, saying, "The difficulty with the idea of signing is this leads to the concept of endorsing code is law. If I had used the keys, which by definition is not signing because identity must be before he used to be a signature, then it would be embracing the argument made by the other side and agreeing that the use of a computer algorithm is more important than the existing common law frameworks we have in place. The thing I realised in 2016 was that if I follow their narrative, that of the people in core, that of Roger Ver, that of all the anarchists, then I am, in fact, embracing the argument that they made. However, in delivering what these individuals want, you are falling into their trap by creating an admission that you need to sign to demonstrate identity. The thing is that it is not true. Identity has never been a function of digital keys. Courts have never required this." So, it's pretty clear here that Wright is admitting to faking some of the 2016 signings for two reasons. The BBC lied to him, and he's had some great epiphany that he would be breaking some kind of Bitcoin code. Is that how you read that passage?
Yeah, I do. Because where Craig says, if I had used the keys, it appears to me that he is admitting that he didn't use the keys. And we should, of course, understand this as private keys. It's typically a rewrite of history again, as we have it from several sources that Craig Wright tried to imply during the proof sessions that he was signing something. But yeah, he didn't, of course, and what we get from Craig now is the closest to an admission that he didn't indeed sign anything, because he couldn't. But yeah, let's also bring back in memory that in May 2021, he declared this in the COPPA case. "Dr. Wright has publicly stated that it is not possible to use the Genesis block to verify his identity as Satoshi Nakamoto, and such is the case. It is admitted that Dr. Wright has not publicly demonstrated his ability to make transactions concerning early blocks in the Bitcoin blockchain, which are associated with Satoshi Nakamoto. However, in March and April 2016, he privately demonstrated to Gavin Andreessen, John Matonis, Rory Sellen-Jones and Ludwig Siegele that he had access to the private key associated with, in the case of Mr. Andreessen and Matonis, blocks 1 and 9 in the Bitcoin blockchain, and in the case of Mr. Sellen-Jones and Siegele, block 9 in the Bitcoin blockchain."
That section is interesting, particularly in the light of Wright's complaining about other people giving knowingly fraudulent testimony, because in admitting that some of his signings were faked, he's admitting to giving knowingly fraudulent testimony. Crucially, Wright doesn't say when he had this supposed epiphany, and so we can't be sure if he's saying he faked the in-person signings as well as the press ones. But I wonder how John Matonis, Gavin Andreessen and all those press guys are feeling right now.
Yeah, they should feel having been part of a Craig Wright bamboozle show, but yeah, do they? Especially about Gavin Andreessen, I have mixed feelings, to be fair. On May 2, 2016, he appeared pretty convinced in his blog post, you might remember, but all his outings after that show mild to very strong doubt. I hope there will be a day that he makes up his mind and totally rejects Craig's claims of being Satoshi. I mean, after all that Gavin received was a questionable signing procedure, a lie from Craig that he would publish a publicly verifiable signature with the Sartre blog post, which didn't happen, as we all know now, and a bunch of excuses why all Gavin's other demands couldn't be fulfilled. So if I were Gavin, I would feel pretty pissed, especially about the Bitcoin that he sent to Block 9 on May the 4th of 2016, and which he never received back. And that should have been a piece of cake for Craig Wright. After all, he did have the private keys, right? But yeah, let's not forget, all those people involved with the signing sessions, they all have signed NDAs and are probably not allowed, and not willing either, to disclose too much.
Of course, as we explored in Series 1, Episode 4 of this podcast, it's a racing certainty that Wright in fact faked all of the signing sessions in 2016. And indeed, this admission here could well cover every signing during that April period. Surely, Stephen Matthews, Calvin Ayer and Robert McGregor are going to have to be having a word with him. I mean, after all, he might have just admitted to intentionally stiffing their multi-billion dollar venture. Plus, he was very happy to sign blocks for them when they wanted to bail him out. If they had any kind of backbone, they'd be onto their lawyers right now, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. There is anecdotal evidence from one of the lawsuits that Craig Wright is involved with that Camp Calvin indeed considered the April-May 2016 signing session series as a failure. And Craig Wright had to pay back $1 million as a penalty for that in, if I remember well, 2017. So I'm not sure if they are going to chase Craig again for it. But by the way, as far as we know now, Robert McGregor is not involved in this multi-billion saga anymore, as he sold his shares in the Victoshi Endeavor in 2017 already, and he quietly disappeared.
I think Calvin Ayer, of all people, knows not to bother chasing Craig for the money because he'll be the one paying it out anyway.
Well, I think Calvin is not totally dumb, as he expects the money to come back at some point. That's why he provides loans to Craig. He's not just giving it away. But as we have seen in the last year, Craig backs these loans with thin air. And that's a friendly word for forgeries, like the OneFix paper wallet with which Craig defrauded him in June 2015. He needed an urgent bailout and he used the OneFix paper wallet for that. And also thin air is, of course, the non-existent Tulip Trust, based on which Calvin loaned him money for his lawsuits. And that probably runs in the tens of millions by now. So yeah, Calvin should prepare himself for never seeing a penny back for the loans he's providing.
Wright's reasoning for not signing with Genuine Keys is also problematic due to his claims that he would have been falling into the trap that ownership of Keys proved identity, something that he says was the mantra of core people. Here, he mentions Roger Ver in particular, as if Wright and he were already on opposing paths, when in fact at this time they were still best buds, a year away from leading the Bitcoin Cash breakaway together, and still 2 years out from the fallout that would lead to the creation of BSV in 2018. Arthur, is Wright suggesting he knew he and Ver would fall out 2 years before they did, and is using this to suggest he didn't sign blocks on ideological grounds?
No, that's not how I understand Craig's rant. It appears to be that Craig Wright was also requested by Roger Ver in that era, probably in 2015 already, when they first met, and Roger Ver came under Craig's Victoshi spell to provide some signing evidence, which he obviously never received, we learn now. From an April 2018 article about Bitcoin Bell on the HackerNoon website, we find anecdotal evidence of this likely having taken place, and allow me to quote from that article. Roger, however, was more than happy to jump at the opportunity of helping Satoshi, as long as Craig was able to provide some form of cryptographical proof. Craig provided the same proof that was refuted by the community a few months later, but Roger was easily duped at this point.
I don't know, I still find it telling that he has never before stated that he wasn't a core person back in 2016, when all the signs were that he most certainly was, and now 5.5 years later he drops this revisionist history bombshell in which he magically predicts a falling out with Roger Ver 2 years before it happened. It's all too convenient. We're going to end this episode with an amusing little tidbit regarding Craig Wright and Elon Musk. Now, Wright has launched a couple of withering attacks on the Tesla founder in the past, but he took things up a notch at the end of December, just 24 hours after an interview went live in which Musk identified Nick Szabo as the man most responsible for the evolution of ideas that led to Bitcoin. In the interview from which we played you a clip earlier, Wright also addressed this snub.
Well, my opinion on that guy is very low. You take the last financial scammers of the last 300 years, you combine them, and they're more honest than Elon combined. I mean, honestly, the guy's a complete pump-and-dump scam artist. He gets in trouble by the SEC, he pays a minor fine, he doesn't care because he makes more money. I mean, if anything, the guy should be carted off and thrown in prison.
Wright went further the same day, telling his BSV acolytes that Honestly, I would not take money from Elon Musk if I was starving. The guy is a scumbag. He breaches rules on a minutely basis. He makes money manipulating others. He is everything wrong with the crypto industry. This attitude, however, is a far cry from Wright's treatment of Musk just 3 months previously, when Wright attempted to entice the world's richest man to join him at a CoinGeek New York conference the following month by playing the sycophant.
You and I both have a long history in innovation, particularly around payments. With your transformational work at X.com and mine as Satoshi Nakamoto inventing Bitcoin, a system designed as a simple digital cash system, we can work together to change things. More personally, we've both had to deal with ill-informed and vicious critics. However, time has demonstrated that we were simply living in a future that they didn't yet recognize. We're inviting people to New York to join us in building the future. I hope you take me up on this offer to join me in solving these issues. I hope to see you at the CoinGeek conference in October. Thank you.
Never before has Wright's two-faced and spiteful nature been quite so shamelessly exposed. When he wants something from someone, he rains praise down on them from the heavens, but the second they do something to upset him, everything else is forgotten and they're dead to him. Musk ignored this invitation, incidentally, which put the BSV crew on damage limitation mode. It was particularly galling for Calvin Ayer, whose CoinGeek outlet had tempted fate by suggesting that Musk would find Wright's invitation too good to refuse, and had pondered on a utopian vision of Wright and Musk working together to save the world. However, rather than admitting that a CoinGeek conference might not have been Musk's cup of tea, Calvin Ayer claimed in the days after the invitation went ignored that "we never expected him to come, he's a PayPal guy," and that it had been CoinGeek's intention to make a public point for the benefit of others. Who these others were and how they benefited by Musk making Wright and CoinGeek look like the girl no one wants to dance with has never been revealed. Incidentally, Wright went on the attack against other entities in the December interview, notably Twitter, whose founder Jack Dorsey is also the founder of one of the companies behind Copa, and the Financial Times, who have reported on Wright unfavourably in the past. Wright claimed in the interview that the FT was like used toilet paper, so it would be interesting if the 134-year-old newspaper suddenly turned around and said Wright is Satoshi after all. Would Wright still say they're not to be trusted? We doubt it. That's everything for this first episode of Series 2 of Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. Arthur, I'm not sure about you, but I thought these were going to be quieter episodes with less to talk about on a monthly basis, but I think I'm living in hope more than expectation there, aren't I?
Yeah, it seems so, Mark. Never a boring day in Fictoshi lawsuit land.
There isn't, not at all. Well, thank you as ever for your wisdom and your insight, and I'll see you next month.
Yeah, you're welcome, Mark. See you in February again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. If you enjoyed what you heard, we'd love it if you could rate and even review us on your podcast app of choice to help us spread the word. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast too in order to get the episodes the moment they drop. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Dr. Bitcoin Pod, that's at Dr. Bitcoin Pod, and you can also email us at drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. That's at drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.
You've been listening to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. Written by Mark Hunter, with additional material by Arthur Van Pelt. Editing and production by Mark Hunter. This has been a Contented Media production.